come to order.
Mr. Chair, could I have privilege of the floor?
Representative Kraft, you may.
Thank you. Up in our gallery today is someone who's not only a very good friend of mine, but a member of the Sweetwater County Leadership Class. She is the field representative, one of the two field representatives in the Rock Springs office for Senator John Barrasso. So please help me welcome Sandy DeRiff.
Representative Shepperson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to take a moment to introduce a very good friend of mine and one of the people that I consider, it might be an oxymoron, but a good attorney. And so, two very good friends of mine, Nicole Thompson Kramer and Joy Jammerman.
Representative Patton.
I want you to hear this. First time for me to introduce two of the finest, loveliest, most talented ladies I have had the pleasure of meeting and knowing. My wife, Virginia, call her Jen, and my daughter-in-law, Debbie Patton. Debbie? Thank you.
Privilege, please.
Representative Millen.
I would like to introduce, Bernadette and I would, a friend of ours, Ron Wild from Evanston. He was in our Leadership Wyoming class. Please welcome him to the House.
One of the stars of the class.
Representative Semlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Privilege to the floor.
Yes, sir.
Members of the 60th, we have some students here visiting today in the North Balcony from the Solid Rock Christian Academy at Moorcroft. They are Alyssa Culver. You stand up, Alyssa. Taylor Warman and Colt Lewis. They are accompanied by one of their teachers, my wife, Sheila. And members of the House, also with them today is my son Toby and my grandson Tatum. A couple years ago, Tatum came down to visit us, and his understanding of the syntax and diction was a little bit off. He said, Papa, are you still down there making claws? And I said, and I think it's sometimes he's more right than we believe. So, welcome to the House.
And I also would like to take a point of privilege, and right up in the balcony straight in front of me is the Sheridan Leadership Institute and their leadership. So.
The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 16, The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 16, introduced by the Revenue Committee, an act relating to property tax review of assessment. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Escobel, Goggles, Madden, Miller, Peterson, Semlek, Wallace. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that Senate File 16 do pass. And I would turn the explanation over to the famous legislator from Buffalo.
Representative Madden.
Thanks a million, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Chairman. This bill, ladies and gentlemen, is an outgrowth of two things, I guess. There was a Senate File 144 Rules Committee that met last year for about half of the year, and among other things, we were looking for ways to make assessors more efficient and improve their lives, I guess. And the other thing that comes about is a vagueness that they observed in the existing statute, and I'll just run through the changes. It's nothing earth-shaking or substantial, I guess, but just some small things that needed to be straightened out. If you look on page 2, down to the underlined portion beginning in line 14 and going through 17, this actually was not in the original bill, but came as an amendment as a result of the Senate actions. And all it says is a county assessor shall, upon request, provide the person or his agent a statement indicating why a certain property was not used and determine the value of his property at issue. And this goes back to the old situation where sometimes, you know, having just information about what properties were used to assess a given taxpayer's property, it's almost as valuable to know why a certain group of properties were not used. And it comes up from time to time that the house will be familiar with somebody that they think it looks like their house or something, and they want to know why. And some assessors would explain that. Other assessors says, well, it doesn't say in the law that it's needed, that an explanation is necessary, and all I'm really obligated to tell you is what information you did use to assess your property. So that's what that one is. And then if you go to the next underlined portion on page 3, starting with line 5, what it does is delineate the definition of geographic area. And this is in direct response to a bill that we passed last year that used the term geographic area, but it didn't define it adequately. And there was a question from an assessor in a given county that asked the attorney general, what does a geographic area mean? And the attorney general, in the absence of any information to the contrary, simply said it's the area of your neighborhood. Well, that didn't do any good because in many, many counties, particularly small counties, comparable properties that are used to assess your property is outside your neighborhood. So it put the assessors in a quandary to abide by this informal opinion of just showing properties within the neighborhood but not being able to show the properties that were actually used as a comparison to assess his property. So that's why that's in there. And then the last one, you'll see that there's a new underlined portion on starting on line 16, and all that says is someone wishing to review an assessment of the property shall contact the assessor not later than 30 days after the date of the assessment schedule. And the way it was worded before, it just said any person wishing to contest. Well, some assessors were saying, well, are you contesting your property value? He says, well, no, I don't want to contest it. I just want to have it reviewed with me. She says, well, I can't give you any of this information unless you agree to contest it. So it just made a lot of busy work for the assessors because there were more or less backing people up into having to contest property values when they only wanted to really review those that information. The last thing here, you'll see where it says postmark date is crossed out, whichever is later is crossed out, and that's a result of the modern changing times in society. We used to always automatically have a cancel date on a letter that you sent out, but if you do bulk mailing like all the assessors do, there is no such thing as a postmark date. So what they do is they date the assessment notice and say from that time on is when the 30-day clock starts. Excuse me. So that's the essence of the bill, and if there's no questions, I guess I move the question.
Is there any discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Anderson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 16 pass the Committee of the Whole, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Senate File 16 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 17. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 17, introduced by the Revenue Committee, an act relating to property statement of consideration. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Madden, Miller, Wallace. No, Escobel, Goggles, Peterson, Semlak. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with recommendation that bill Senate File 17 do pass. And I'll try to explain the bill. I guarantee you this one will cause a little more controversy than the last one we had. This is an old friend. We've seen it in Revenue Committee I don't know how many times. One of the reasons for passing it would be so we didn't have to look at it again. But that's not a very good reason, however. So we will start the discussion. What this does right now, residential property is confidential information, sort of. It has really is. It looks like the bill we just passed takes care of some of that. That is altogether a different program. And the bill first is I was instructed by the assessors in the committee room. It kind of straightens up some language in this present statutes. This definitely does some changing. The reason that I am for the bill is that if indeed you're going to tax my property on the basis of sale of other property, then I need to know what that is. And you can find that out now if you go through a certain number of steps and jumps and hoops, you can find that out. Some of the opposition you're seeing to this bill is coming from realtors. Their stand for it is about 50% for it, 50%. So the realtors organization themselves don't have an answer. Those that you're getting their emails on are those that want to keep that information themselves. They have access to that, and they would rather that you didn't know it until they told you. That's one of the reasons for it. This bill came to us last year at the request of a realtor. And there was enough opposition to it that it didn't pass on it. And essentially that's what it does is residential property only, and it'll become a public record restricted hardly at all. I think if you would wish, we could put some amendments in there to restrict it somewhat, but Let's get the debate started.
Discussion? Representative Hales.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a bill that I have struggled with, and for two reasons. I don't know how many of you have purchased a home in the last 3 or 4 years, but if you have, when you look at the statement of consideration, there are four things on that statement of consideration. The price you paid for the home, your loan amount, your interest rate, and what your monthly payment is. And that is absolutely all that is on the statement of consideration. So now what my concerns are, and this is a decision that you all have to make, is whether you want this information about how much you paid for the home and what amount of money you put down, public knowledge. To me, it's a privacy right, and I find it very interesting that the commercial part of this is not in the bill, because those people dealing in commercial property don't want that information out there. The second problem that I see with this bill is it really does not tell the public what they want to know. It does not tell them, other than the price, the square footage of the house, the number of bedrooms, the number of baths, anything that they can make a realistic assessment of. In my neighborhood, for example, within a two-block area, we have homes that are assessed from $40,000 to $300,000. If you go in and look at those, you have no way of gathering the information that you need to make an assessment of your property. What I really think we're doing with this bill is leading the public down the primrose path, because it just doesn't help them at all. I would much rather see us come back next year with a bill that would give them all of the information that they need, not only price, but the square footage of the lot, the bedrooms, the baths, and then you have a way of getting to this information. But other than that, you just don't have any way to compare properties. And for that reason, I find it a little difficult to vote for this bill. Thank you.
Representative Semlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have some concerns about this bill, too, and it will come from a little bit different perspective from what the first speaker from House District 36 had to say. My concerns are not so much of the information that can be provided for the benefit of appraisers or for the benefit of realtors. My concern with this bill really deals with something that's pretty important to us, and that is privacy and the ability for us to protect information with respect to our property. I just give you an example of a hypothetical situation. If you have a home across the street from you and it has recently sold, you can go over to the neighbors who have recently purchased this property and ask them what that property sold for. And most likely they'll tell you in so many words, it's really none of your business. So the what we have to consider with the passage of this bill, that the information with respect to the name of the grantor or the grantee in this title, the date of the transfer, the date of the sale, a legal description of the property transferred, the actual full amount paid or to be paid for the property, the terms of the sale, and the estimate of the value of any non-real property included in the sale will be available for public disclosure. Now, this this would, in the full extent of what we're contemplating here, would allow any newspaper in the community, any newspaper presumably in the state or the nation, to get a list of the statements of consideration and publish it in their paper, daily, weekly, whatever. So why do we need this bill? You know, that there's been an argument made that we need this bill so that taxpayers will have the ability to get the information that has been used in terms of comparable values that went into the determination of the assessment of the property. And as the previous bill moves through the system, and I hope it does pass, I submit to you that everything that will be needed will be provided, and most of it is provided now for the ability for taxpayers to have remedy if they want to get the information from the assessor as to what what comparable values have been used to determine the value of their properties and how it was assessed. So that information is available during the interim work and during the testimony of this bill in the standing committee. I was very interested in that aspect, if that was possible, that that information would be available. And I was assured either by the just general practice of the assessors that you can go up to the window and you could find out every property that was used to determine what the value of your property was in terms of the assessment. So I would submit to you that information is currently available, particularly with the provisions in the previous bill that we just talked about. And I just don't see a need for us to open this up to for everybody to know exactly what's going on with the sale of your property. I think that's an issue of privacy. I think we need to respect that. And at the same time that we're respecting the privacy of the people who own this property, there's a system in place that would allow for a remedy if the taxpayer feels that their property wasn't assessed correctly. So in closing, in the final testimony of this bill upstairs, I want to be clear about that. And I got a very clear and concise answer from the assessors. I said, "Does this bill really necessary?" And the answer that I received was no. So with that, I would ask that we do not move this bill forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think, as most of you know, I come from a background where it's extremely inappropriate to discuss money. If you ask a rancher how much land he or she owns or how many cattle they have, it's kind of the equivalent of asking them how much money they have in the bank. It's just not something we do in this state. But in spite of that, I think we need this bill. There are a lot of taxpayers out there who are very frustrated with our system of assessing property, and they don't feel as if they can get the information they need to fully understand what's going on with our tax assessment system. And it's in the residential area, but not exclusively. And as I understand this bill, it only deals with residential. Just a quick bit of history. This bill, in some form, came before us last year. It died in committee because I think a large number of realtors opposed it. I knew we needed to do something, so I quickly crafted a bill to provide for more information in tax appeals, which is the previous bill you just looked at. And, you know, obviously we had to come back this year and do some corrections to that. And the reason I give you that little bit of background is, you know, yes, can taxpayers go ahead with their appeals and get some information? Yes, they can, because we did that last year and we're fixing mistakes this year. But this is better. This gives taxpayers more access to information, to the information they feel they need to really understand their taxes. And we all know how people get about their taxes. They get very passionate. They want information. They want to understand why their property assessment went up when it seems like the market's going down. So I would urge everyone, I understand the privacy concerns. It's, you know, we're pretty private in Wyoming about our personal finances. I understand that. But this is a bill that's needed, and it seems like the opposition to it has primarily gone away from the groups that opposed it last year. And maybe it's not necessary for the assessors, but it'll certainly make their lives easier. Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I rise in opposition to the bill, as pointed out by the good representative from up in the Moorcroft area. He certainly was very artful in describing what's happened. I voted no in the committee, could find no compelling reason why we should support this legislation. As we look at these various bills and proposed legislation, I think it's one of the functions that we need to look at on unnecessary legislation. We don't burden the statutes. We don't go forward and cast some kind of affirmative burden on the individuals. The information, as pointed out, is readily available from those who are not happy with their assessment. They can go to the assessor and they can obtain properties that are like use in geographic area readily at hand. We also find that if this bill were to pass, as previously pointed out, it doesn't touch commercial, it doesn't touch ranching properties. It's an incomplete piece of legislation, and I would certainly urge the body to vote against it.
Representative Illoway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and against Senate File 17, we just passed 16. That's a reasonably good piece of legislation, which I do hope it goes ahead. Only have a couple comments. This is just too much intrusion into people's lives. Looks like they left out commercial. I'm not sure why. Maybe even the ranch land was left out, although I know ranch land is sometimes sold on productivity. I've certainly got a lot of emails asking that question, why was commercial and ranch land left out, and that was by the realtors. I just don't think it's necessary. An intrusion into your own life, not necessary. Let's vote it down.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can give you an answer on the commercial property, why that's not in there, and I can also give you an answer on why ag property isn't in there. It wouldn't even have to be for a bill like this for residential property if it wasn't the fact that all residential property is assessed based on a sales ratio or a market comparison approach. If we didn't have a market-based appraisal, there'd be no reason to have any statements of consideration available to anybody at any time. Now, with agriculture property, the reason there's no need to have that one is because for assessment purposes, agricultural property is not based upon its selling price. It doesn't matter whether it sells for $10,000 an acre or $1,000 an acre. It's all based on productivity, and it doesn't have anything to do with the sale price. With commercial property, the reason that's not in there, there's two reasons. One reason is that commercial property has not been an issue as far as appeal processes and things like this. And the reason for that is that there's other ways of assessing commercial property that's more appropriate, and that would be most often the income approach. So you don't need the sales ratio. In fact, the sales data would probably be misleading because so many times there's blue sky that you're purchasing in connection with the sale of a real estate or with a commercial property. And, of course, that's not part of the value of the structure, and so it would cause more confusion than it's worth. As far as the statement of consideration being whether it's useful information or not is not the issue. The issue is that it's used in assessing individual residential property. And we don't need to know anything more about it except that's on a statement of consideration is what was the real estate value as far as what the market price was. And if you don't have that, then you have the problem of a taxpayer not having benefit of the same information as an assessor does. So that's been decided already in the previous bills, among other bills or other parts of the statute. Right now, if my memory is right, there are five states that have a statement of consideration restriction like ours. In those other five states, or other four states, to the best of my knowledge, don't base their assessed value on sale prices. It doesn't have anything to do with it. They'll use square feet or age and depreciation or something like that. And then I would agree that you don't need it. Others that gave testimony in the committee in support of this, such as the Department of Revenue, the Ad Valorem Division, said that it's a matter of transparency. They get calls, and they say, well, we can't give you that. And they say, why not? Because it's not after or within the 30-day window. And assessors run into the same thing. We heard testimony from assessors all summer long that says that, you know, they can't get, if a taxpayer doesn't come in within that 30-day window from the time they've given notice, and they come in, they say, I'd like to know just why my property is assessed the way it is. And they say, well, I can't tell you until 11 more months have passed. We've got to wait until that 30-day window. And then the taxpayer will say, well, why is that? Why can't I ask today instead of waiting 11 months? And the assessor is stuck with it saying, well, it's because it's a law. And then, you know, that doesn't end the argument. The taxpayer will say, well, why is the law written that way? And then there is really no good answer for it. So that's why that's looking at some of the arguments on the other side. I'm convinced if we had this this law in the books, that it would reduce the appeal process. The assessors thinks that it would reduce drastically the confusion that they have to put up with taxpayers. It's a matter of transparency for them as well as transparency on the part of the Department of Revenue. Now, I do see it. There's a problem. I don't think there's any reason why this should lead to or should be allowed to lead to publications in the newspaper. And I think that the representative from District 1 has an amendment on second reading that will nail that down so just a taxpayer that's a property owner can get these. And all it's doing is just it provides openness to the taxpayer year-round instead of on a 30-day window basis, which we have now. So that's the considerations I hope you will take into mind when we debate this further.
Madam Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I thought this bill would help the taxpayer, I would be all for it. There is nothing I would rather see than the taxpayer have the information that they need. But when you go in and look at properties in your area and you look at the sales price, you do not know whether that property was a foreclosed property, whether the price was reduced because it was a divorce, whether it was reduced because it was an estate sale. Even when those of us that are in the business do these market analyses, these are the things that we use to make a market prediction. And it really is not fair to the public to ask them to do that. We just need to find a better way to give them the information, and then I'd be all for it, but I just don't think this bill does what it's purported to do. Thank you.
Representative Peasley.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Excuse me, one of those almonds went down the wrong way. I don't have a lot to say about this, Mr. Chairman. I practice law now for 40-some years, and I remember when I first got into practice, real estate transactions were always interesting because you'd see on the old deeds these revenue stamps that you had to post to, I guess, to make these transactions. And over the years, it frustrated me initially, why in the world did they make us fill out these statements of consideration? And I know it happened, I think, as part of a statewide reassessment. They were trying to gather all this data. And with, and as it is with most of these government programs, everybody tells you, don't worry about it. It's confidential. It all makes sense. We just give it to your trusted little assessor, and you get it all figured out. And my problem has always been with this process, not so much the confidentiality, because I do think that's important. And I think it's more important than a lot of you like to know. I've even had people refuse to give the price at which a property was sold to an appraiser because they were embarrassed about how they got hammered or how much they lost on the transaction and how their property was sold for a lot less than they were telling everybody they did. So there was a little bit of hiding behind that veil. But there was also the fear that, of course, with all the drunk drivers and all the criminals that got picked up and all the divorces that were filed, there will be all these transactions of real estate appear in the newspaper, and maybe you can handle that. I don't know. But what I do know is that the alchemy that these wizards work at the courthouse is not that clear. And I'm going to give one anecdotal story of about 20 years ago. Right after, well, it was a while after the statement of considerations came out, I had a client that purchased a failed business that occupied a block and a half in the Jackalope City. And we bought it at a foreclosure sale price. So the business that was there before, if we use the income approach, was making less than zero. Bought it for around $300,000. The very next year, the assessor appraised it or assessed it at $1.6 million. And, you know, all I could do is go up and say, where in the world did you get that? And, of course, it was because they can't get it from a comparable. They couldn't get it from the income approach. So they used a replacement value. And, of course, it was a dump. It needed a lot of work, but they just simply set it on a square footage basis. So there is a lot of this weird stuff going on. On the other hand, the process is still good to challenge it. And I don't think that just kicking out all the residential values is going to work. And I don't think it's the best thing to do. And I just think that you ought to, rather than run this by every year, as we seem to do so many bills in this body, we keep running the ones that a few people like until we finally give up and pass it. I think the statement here, and I think it's especially fair for the small homeowners who don't want all their neighbors knowing when they sold their house and moved up, or the person that buys a house and comes into a neighborhood, so all the neighbors say, well, they got their house a lot cheaper than we did. I don't know. There's something abhorrent about it, and I just don't think it fits in our view of the world. I don't like statements of consideration to start with. So it makes a little difference in that regard, as you know, and I won't get on my rant on that particular subject, but I think they're bad to begin with, and I think if you're just going to publish them, you're just going to have a lot of people not filling in the right numbers and ducking around and hiding. And thank you, and I'll have another almond. Thank you.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess when we are talking about your private property rights, there's lots of different types of fences out there you can jump over or break down or go around, and it's just not the fence that goes around your property. You have cyber fences and financial fences and things that you would rather keep to yourself, and there are ways out there that you can work with your assessors if you think that you've been taxed unfairly, but jumping over these types of fences is kind of offensive. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any more discussion? Representative Thompson.
Thank you. At first blush, you wonder what's happening here. This is a for those of us that are kind of wavering on this public information sort of thing, this is an FYI, and leaving it up to you to make a decision, maybe a more clear focus on it. This is published, part of this I'm repeating here, from Sweetwater County and from an area in Sweetwater County. And this is dealing with the public information, and it's available on the county website through a program called the GIS. And the Sweetwater County Commissioners got a demonstration of this, and then it was published in the paper, the website, the whole bit, and step by step, even I could follow it, on how to get to this information that is public knowledge. The system's capabilities, the residents can, in the Sweetwater County site, Sweetwater County's 10,400 and some square miles, about 6.5 sizes, Rhode Island you could throw in geographically, just to give some of us who are not familiar with the size of Sweetwater County. Sweetwater County, left side of the computer screen to give you instructions here. And here's what the toolbar does. It enables a user to zoom in on a particular section of Sweetwater County. And then you click on the magnifying icon, and it'll bring the user back to the original map. And you can move the map from left to right, and the computer, mice, and the wheels, and so on. You can go anywhere you want in Sweetwater County. You can click on a piece of property, and a screen box is showing who lives there, the name, what the taxable acreage is of that land, the deed information, and, as they say it, similar data. And by clicking on detail, as if that weren't enough, that's a editorial comment there, further information appears. This is what the assessed value of the property is, and other options, and you can jump to, and you know how many bedrooms, bathrooms, a resident has, square footage of the residence, and its garage, and similar information. Notice this word, similar information. Now, I could go on and on with this. I think we got the message probably way back when. This is already in existence, this stuff right here. And what we're looking at in front of us, but additional, however you feel about that sort of thing, and I appreciate your indulgence for letting me go through this with you, but I think that is important for us to know.
Is there any other discussion? Representative?
Ladies and gentlemen, make no mistake, there's rage out there. Why is there rage out there? There really is. I think the fundamental thing to think about here is knowledge is power. The one that has the knowledge has the power. Who has the knowledge right now? Basically two people, the assessor and the realtors. And that's where the rage comes in, is those who are being denied the knowledge against those who have the knowledge. Now, it is true, I heard it said a couple times, it is true, if you go and talk to the assessor will show you all the properties that were used in computing your assessment. What they won't show you is the other properties that maybe were more relevant to the assessed value of your property. And they won't show you that, and that's transparency. That's what we talk about with transparency. And who has the knowledge and who has the power? The assessor. Now, the realtors work hard to get it. I'll give them that. They work hard to get it, but they have that knowledge, and that's a source of a lot of their power. So the real question for realtors is, what are you selling? Are you selling information? Or are you selling services? And I guess you can each answer your own to your own satisfaction about which way you think that ought to be. There's one interesting thing about this that I've been thinking about as we've been voting on guns. We've talked about guns in this place till I don't know if I ever want to see one again. And I think one of the fundamental things that drives all these gun arguments is paranoia about the government. And that paranoia manifests itself, and I don't want to buy a permit. I don't want the cops doing this. I don't want them doing that. And it's me against the government. And that same paranoia you might think about in this argument over whether this information is going to be public or not. Because there are a lot of people that think the assessors are, they have just as a paranoid opinion of the assessors as a lot in terms of these values as people do about guns. And they're convinced that the assessors aren't using the right values, that they're not comparing them to the right properties, that the state's system that is being used isn't selecting the right things. And again, it comes down to knowledge is power. So that is the source of the rage. And believe me, there are people out there who have a very dim view of assessors. It would lift a great cloak, a great burden from the assessors if they could release all the information and say, there it is. There's everything in the community. You know everything that I know. Now, if you got a problem, let's talk about the problem instead of talking about what I know that you don't. So on and for the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Discussion, Representative Lubno.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and against the bill. I guess it's a question of who do we work for? Do we work for the assessors or do we work for the taxpaying public? I see this, and maybe it is my paranoia, as an encroachment of government. First, we set up the tax system, and then we tell people that we have to tell the government on a statement of consideration what we paid. And when we had those people file those statements of consideration, we promised to keep them confidential, and it even says that on the form. And now we're changing that to say that everybody can know everything about you. But only if you buy residential property, if you buy agricultural property or commercial property, that doesn't count because that can stay private because people want that private. But if you buy a house, you have to tell what you paid for, what your mortgage is, where it comes from. And that kind of transparency is bad. It's nobody's business. And sometimes, like transparency is bad in some areas. Clothing, you don't want transparent clothing. Bank accounts, there's just stuff. Medical records, those are the kind of things that I think we need to stand against an ever-encroaching government. And I think we need to draw the line and say that, you know, there's just some things about me that I don't want you to know, and the government shouldn't have the right to tell everybody about me. And so I think it's important we draw the line here and we keep some things private, and this is one of those things I think we ought to keep private.
Discussion, Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have feuding attorneys yet again. I think that the last speaker missed a point in that the taxpayer who wants statements of consideration is probably not just idly curious about how much money their neighbor spent on their house. They need the information and they want the information because their own taxes don't make sense to them. And this is not something that I come to because of a lot of issues in my own county, although I do hear from frustrations from my own county. Because of the bills I sponsored last year, I hear from people all over the state who are frustrated. And they want more information and they want to understand why their assessed value went up 25% one year for no apparent reason, and they can't get the information to answer their question. They're not being nosy neighbors. The government used this information to figure out their tax assessment, and they have a right to see it. And it would be simpler for the assessors if they didn't have to know which were private and when they could release it, and you know, are they going to get in trouble because they released something they shouldn't have released? If it's all public, we don't have that problem. Thank you.
Representative Gingery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have the one community that has probably the most real estate agents, maybe all put together. And this is how I understand what they do. You know, when they sell a house, they report back to their multi-listing. So they certainly have the information themselves. They control that information.
You know, you can try and figure out what a house sold for. I mean, it usually was in the paper when it was for sale, and they had a price listed there. We always, in my community, we enjoy reading those because, you know, some of them are these multi-million-dollar mansions, and it's strange to see a home for sale for $6 million. And whether or not they got the $6 million or not, I don't know. I don't really care. But you can sort of figure it out. You can look in the paper what they were selling it for. You can look at the assessed value, as it was pointed out earlier. Assessed values are certainly, those are public knowledge. And you can always look at the mortgage. The mortgage is filed at the courthouse, and most of our communities are now online, so you can pull up the actual mortgage as a PDF, and you can see what they're paying on a mortgage. So you can start piecing it together. So, you know, you can figure out most of this information. Why we need to continue the secrecy idea, to keep everything secret, when most of us are figuring it out anyway? The only people that are really benefiting from this system is the real estate agents, because they're controlling the information. The appraisers, when you ask the appraisers, well, how are you determining that value when you don't have access to statement of considerations? And they say, well, I just call the real estate agent. They tell me exactly what they sold it for. And the difficulty is that by controlling the information, you start to run into this problem where potentially, and I'm not saying it's your communities, but definitely was happening in my community, where they're able to keep prices high because they're telling you what the price should be, not the free market. The free market's not telling you the price. A real estate agent's telling you the price, and they want to continue to keep those prices up. And so by keeping the value secret, so nobody really knows what they were, they keep ratcheting up. And so the assessor just follows behind. You have that problem where we had values of property rising so high, and now in my community we have lots of foreclosures because people were paying, you know, numbers that made absolutely no sense. I mean, people that were coming into our state from out of state buying second homes, and they didn't understand the true values because they were being inflated. And now suddenly these people are in a lot of trouble. That's the problem. You don't allow one group to control information. You allow it to be public. There's no compelling state reason to continue with secrecy of these documents.
Discussion? Representative Anderson?
Thank you. Certainly, I promised you some debate on this issue. Didn't think it'd get this far or this deep. Again, the commercial property is no statement of consideration doesn't do any good. You can explain that by with one word, blue sky. That's all different on that. Agriculture land is taxed based on production, not on the price. Very few agriculture land is sold on production anymore. Value. It's all something else. And then, but the assessors would appreciate this because it'll make their job a lot less stressful. They can let these figures know. This is, again, a figure of transparency of government. If you're going to tax my property on the basis of sales, of residential property on the basis of sales, there's no reason why I shouldn't know what those bases are. And certainly maybe there should be some restrictions on that. I don't think anybody else is going to be curious about it. But I just think if you're for transparency in government, you got to be for this bill. If you want to keep things under the under wraps don't know why you're getting taxed for what, then certainly you ought to be in opposition to the bill.
Representative Hale.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that there is maybe some error in the thinking about what real estate agents do or do not do. if you want a market analysis done to give you a value on your property, they will do that for you. They will do that for you without charge. Anyone who wants to get information from the multiple listing system, and that goes for the appraisers. They simply become a member of that organization. And as far as I know, almost all of the appraisers in the state belong to their respective multiple listing systems. As far as the citizen being able to get information from their assessor, you go to the assessor's office, you pay them a dollar, they'll pull up any information that you want. It will be a drawing, it will be an assessed value, it will be the lot size, it'll give you the bedrooms, the baths, the whole thing. And when I do a market analysis, I go to the assessor and I get that information. It isn't some information that I have hidden in a file. I go to the assessor, and that's the basis on which I do my market analysis. Thank you.
Is there any other discussion on this bill? Question having been called, all those in favor of Representative Anderson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate file number 17 do pass. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The motion fails. All those in favor, please stand. All those opposed, please stand. Senate File 17, having failed, we'll do a roll call vote. The Chief Clerk will call the roll.
Anderson, Bagby, Barbudo, Berger, Berger, Blake, Flickery, Bonner, Brechtel, Brown, Buchanan, Bird, Kennedy, Carson, Childers, Cohey, Cohey, Connolly, Kraft, Davison, Dirks, Edmonds, Esquivel, Gilmore, Gingery, Goggles, Hales, Hallinan excused, Hammonds, Harshman, Harvey, Harvey excused, Illaway, Illaway, Yagi, Jorgensen, Kimball, Landon, Lockhart, Lubno, Madden, McKim, McComey, Miller, Millen, Moniz, Patton, Peasley, Patterson, Peterson, Philp excused, Korberg, Roscoe, Simlick, Shepperson, Stewart, Stubson, Teeters, Thompson, Throne, Wallace, Zwanitzer Dan, Zwanitzer Dave, Mr. Speaker, Cohey, Cohey excused. I'm about to close the vote. Are there any changes? McComey, aye to no. Are there any other changes? The vote is closed, 20 ayes, 36 noes, 4 excused.
Senate File 17 has failed to pass the Committee of the Whole and is indefinitely postponed. Representative Blake, privilege of the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to introduce one of our past co-workers here in the House of Representatives, probably down here to keep an eye on her husband. Please welcome back Mary Gilmore.
Representative Gilmore, privilege of the floor.
She told me she would kill me if I announced her, so that's... And I went upstairs and asked her if she had any advice, and she said, remind those people this is a budget session and get on with this trivial stuff.
The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 43. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 43, introduced by Senator Meyer, an act relating to game and fish special hunting season extension. This bill was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Bonner, Brown, Childers, Connolly, Davison, Yagi, Millen, Shepperson, Thompson. Signed, Representative Childers, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Representative Childers?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that Senate File 43 engrossed do pass. And I'll explain the bill. Well, Mr. Chairman, this fairly simple bill that basically is extending the hunting season for the disabled. And if you'll go down to the bottom of page 1, line 15 and 16 is three words on the second page is the gist of the amendment to the statutes. It basically says to fix seasons and bag limits, open, shorten, or close season, including providing for season extensions for hunters with disabilities as established by commission rules and regulations. And, of course, the established by commission rules and regulations were added between the original bill and the engrossed bill. And basically, people with disabilities typically need more time in hunting seasons, and this provides it. There are no questions? I'll call for the question.
Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Childers' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill Senate File number 43 do pass. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Senate File 43 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 47. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 47, introduced by Senator Schiffer, an act relating to paramutual wagering, simulcasting. This bill was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Brown, Childers, Connolly, Yagi, Millen, Shepperson, Thompson. No, Bonner, Davison. Signed, Representative Childers, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Representative Childers?
This is fun. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 47 in gross do pass, and I further move the Standing Committee Amendment. And I'm going to turn it over to the good lady from north of Casper to explain the bill.
Representative Shepperson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, we have Senate File 47, which is a paramutual wagering bill. But hold the presses, it's not a gambling bill. So don't get your cackles in an uproar. Basically, what has happened here is the horse racing industry in Wyoming has suffered significant losses in the state. We used to have racetracks in Casper, in Gillette, in Sheridan, and Rock Springs. And right now, the only place we have them is in Evanston. And we would really like to work to keep that track going. The problem has arisen where there's been a conflict between the racing commission, the track, and the horse owners. So what this bill attempts to do is bring all the parties to the table and say, you guys figure it out. We're giving them local control with a governor's appointed commission. The big bone of contention has been the actual simulcasting. Now, I don't know how much all of you guys know about simulcasting. I didn't know a lot until I started digging into this bill. But the live horse racing itself technically has not been very profitable. And so they started doing the simulcasting, and that's where the big money comes in. And with the simulcasting, the track or the off-track betting or whatever you want to call it, can do the simulcasting with a permit if they do so many days of live racing is the way the commission has been doing things. And with the simulcasting, everybody gets a little bit of the pie, a little piece of the pie. The horseman gets a little bit piece of the pie. The state gets a little piece of the pie. The operator gets a little piece of the pie. And so it's mutually beneficial for everyone. The problem has come in where a certain company has wanted to not do the live racing and do more of the paramutual events, and that's created a huge bone of contention. So just to fast forward through a lot of meetings and hurt feelings and bad press, we have come up with this bill, and I'm going to go ahead and ask for you to vote aye on the Standing Committee Amendment, but then we're going to also change it with a Committee of the Whole Amendment where all parties that have involved have come to a compromise solution on this that we think is going to work. It's going to be economically viable for the track. It's going to be a solution that works for the commission and hopefully a win-win for the state of Wyoming and for the horse people and basically for everyone involved. So with that, I will ask for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment or see if there are any other questions on Standing Committee Amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At this time, I would move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 47. As I said earlier, this is a compromise solution between all parties involved. If you look at the original bill, we had a set number of racing days in there. We had the commission is going to do this. The horse owners are going to do that. We decided that is overstepping our bounds. We as a legislature don't have the knowledge to be able to set those parameters. So we are removing that language. We're saying the commission will set the parameters, whether it be for live racing or for paramutual days. But you set the parameters, and if those parameters are met, then they'll get the simulcasting permit. So I think we have some other comments on the Committee of the Whole Amendment, so I will pass it on.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just echo the sponsor's words that this is a compromise that's going to work for everyone in this situation. It started out being very contentious. The business that was involved was being mandated to provide live days of racing at a loss, and the very clear message was that they, as a business, would not be able to survive under those circumstances. So in a situation where we didn't want to lose the only remaining track in the state, this brings the parties together to figure out what's economically viable and would allow for the simulcasting around the state and the those portions that were already designated to be shared in order to enhance the equine industry. So we think this is a great compromise. We've got the agreement of all the parties, and I can tell you that that was arduous and surprising, I think, and we're just tickled to death and hope that you support it.
Representative McComey.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, my county has contacted me and asked me to support this bill. We have a very active group of people, and they have seen the same demise that's been talked about. So I will be on and for the bill because I agree with them. Thank you.
Right. We are on the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1. Representative Jefferson.
I would call for the question on the Committee of the Whole Amendment unless Representative Connolly wants to speak on the amendment.
I didn't see her. Representative Connolly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and in favor of the amendment and the bill, I just want to commend the bringers of the amendment. In 24 hours, they figured out what was an incredibly contentious issue in committee, and I commend them, and I strongly encourage the body to support both the amendment and the bill.
The question having been called, all those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. We're on the bill. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the House, certainly this piece of legislation is something we need. Wyoming Downs is what we're talking about. It's in my legislative district. It's located about 12 miles south of Evanston. It does provide employment in the summertime, the seasons that take place there, as well as the off-track bedding that we've already addressed. Many of the issues have been pointed out here. There needed to be clarification because there was this ongoing feud between the Paramutual Commission that oversees the operation of the Wyoming Downs and then the Wyoming Downs with their number of race days. Numerous horse owners and the breeding associations have talked to me about this. I've met with the current owners of the Downs, and there has been some, misunderstandings that take place. I think this clarifies and sets everybody on the straight path. We need to keep the Downs going because it is an industry that is kind of tradition of the state. It's horse racing type situation. We've had folding of numerous tracks, not only in the state of Wyoming, but in the surrounding states. So it's an important entity that we take place. But this will give authorization to the commission to go forward and establish the days. It's within their scope and function, and I'm very pleased to see this come forward. It took a lot of effort. I commend those that worked on it and would certainly ask the support of the body.
Mr. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to say I was a no vote just yesterday in committee, and it was this was the situation. Neither side, not one time, said they believe this could be worked out. So my congratulations to the arbiters who in the last day have reached this agreement, and I am ready to support the bill. Thank you.
Question being called, all those in favor of Representative Childers motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 47 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 47 has passed the Committee of the Whole.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dirks.
Requesting privilege of the floor.
Yes, sir.
Members of the House, there's a young lady in the gallery that's been watching this body since she was 2 years old, and for some reason wants to continue watching so much that even though she was in a car wreck this morning, she's still up in the gallery. She's the 2008 Girls State Governor, and she's waiting for that Mark Twain experience when her father finally accrues the wisdom that she's been waiting for. Diane Dirks, thank you for coming. Hey!
The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 51. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 51, introduced by Senator Anderson, an act relating to the state official state code, adopting the Code of the West as the official state code. This bill was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Brechtel, Byrd, Kraft, Harvey, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Representative Lockhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that Senate File 51 do pass. Every now and again, the body on the other side of this building sends us an excellent piece of work. And you're about to hear an explanation of that excellent piece of work from the representative from House District 46. And I believe this is his first Minerals Committee bill to cover for the House. So with your permission, Mr. Chairman, representative from House District 46 will explain the bill.
Representative Moniz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for such an easy bill, Chairman of the Minerals Committee. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring to you Senate File 51, the official state code. I think it's very well written. It basically states on page 1, line 11, the Code of the West, as derived from the book Cowboy Ethics by James P. Ullman, and summarized as follows, is the official code of Wyoming. The code includes, Romanette little a, live each day with courage. 2, take pride in your work. 3, always finish what you start. 4, do what has to be done. 5, be tough but fair. 6, when you make a promise, keep it. 7, ride for the brand. 8, talk less and say more. 9, remember that some things are not for sale. And number 10, know where to draw the line. We have a number of people that I'm sure are willing to speak and want to speak to this issue. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for questions.
Representative Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple comments. How many of you got a chance to look at the CD with the representative starring in it over the weekend? I hope y'all, come on, she's, Well, I don't know where that representative is. Anyway, I did happen to see the premiere in Laramie. It's a great piece, and if you don't have a chance while you're down here, try and at least see it sometime. Let me read just some excerpts from the author. That would be fine if I knew that y'all were for it. These are some remarks by the author, Jim Owens, of the Wyoming legislature, and he says, for the last 6 years, I've been writing and speaking about the American cowboy. I don't mean Roy Rogers or Gene Autry or any of those Western stars I grew up watching at the Saturday matinees. I'm talking about the real-life cowboy, the working cowboy who's out mending fences in blazing heat, who saddles up in a blinding snowstorm to go out and rescue a stranded calf. A figure who I believe represents the best of America, the courage, the optimism, the self-reliance, and the plain hard work that built this great country. In my book, Cowboy Ethics, and a companion book, Cowboy Values, and in more than 150 speeches and workshops around the country, I have voiced my belief that America is seriously off track. To my mind, we need to get back to fundamental principles of right and wrong, back to common sense, core values like honesty, loyalty, and courage. Back to the principles we call the Code of the West. Last spring, I started working on a film project called Code of the West, Alive and Well in Wyoming. Having given at least a dozen speeches in Wyoming, I'd had the chance to meet people here and see firsthand what your state is really like. And I came to see that there truly is something unique about the way of life here. There's a wholesome spirit of genuineness and community, a deep connection with the land, and a clear set of values shared by hardworking people who take real pride in living by their beliefs. At a time when every state in the union is tightening its belt and looking for ways to boost its economy, Wyoming has a strong built-in appeal. You can build a whole campaign around the idea that this may be the last authentic place in America. Every state has its flag, its state bird, its state gem, but as far as I know, no state has an official code. If Wyoming becomes the first state to adopt the Code of the West as its banner, it will help showcase what truly sets you apart. So I respectfully urge this body to vote unanimously in favor of the measure before you today. Thank you.
Is there any other discussion? Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, this discussion kind of reminds me of a story. A friend of mine told me that, you know, you can ride a horse your whole life and nobody will ever call you a cowboy. But rob one bank, and you're a bank robber.
Representative Childers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to me it sort of looks like this particular code is sort of like the way Congress does with the rest of the citizens of the United States, that this won't apply to the state legislature, because I'm reading Romanex 8, where it says, talk less and say more. And I just got a real problem that I don't think we've been doing that. And there may be a few others that may present a problem. But, you know, I'm probably going to vote for it. But I think it's going to be tough for apply to us unless we get to work.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to rise in opposition to this. Well, for 18 years, I thought we were operating under this code, and I don't think it's changed, and I appreciate that.
Representative Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would urge all of you to look at that CD, and if you don't, that doesn't warm your heart, nothing in the world will. These cards that I had circulated around just before the meeting, they're a good thing for the men to put in their shirt pockets and the women to put in their purses as a reminder of how we actually operate. And I had the CD, and I loaned it out, and I haven't gotten it back. But I also have a book by Owen that I've put into a loaner's library that is so good about Wyoming, everybody ought to see it. But I'd like to have this one back, but it is available to you. I urge your support of the bill.
Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Lockhart's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate file number 51 do pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate file 51 has passed the Committee of the House, Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 72. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 72, introduced by the Appropriation Committee, an act relating to the Wyoming Retirement System Plan contributions. This bill was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Stewart, no, Hammonds, Harshman, excused, Phelp, signed, Representative Berger, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 72 do pass, and I defer explanation of the bill to Representative Pedersen.
Representative Pedersen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bring before you Senate File 72, and I wanted to go over some talking points as to why this is necessary, why we are where we are, and why this is so important. I passed out a piece that you all have in your handout box. It says Senate File 72, increased contributions to the Wyoming retirement system. And what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to flip to page 2. And on page 2, you'll see right in the center of it, you see a nice little chart. And this kind of is going to illustrate where we are. What you have there is a valuation as of January 1st of each one of those years. And then underneath it, it's unfunded accrued liability and the fully funded ratio. So how that works in 2009 is that our unfunded accrued liability is about $1.1 billion, which means that we are funded at 81.5%. Now, going forward with this, this plan illustrates what happens if we have 11.25, which is our current contribution rate, maintaining, and then we also assume an 8% average annualized return and no COLAs. What happens to the account? And we talk about this, being far off, that where we will be short of being fully funded. And as you can see here, it's 2013 is the big year. 2013, we're 68.3% fully funded, which is actuarially unfunded. That's where you're to the point where you won't be able to make up the difference unless you vastly increase contributions. And what that amount is actually, if we were to put it off till 2013, that contribution rate would have to be over 17.25%. Instead of moving to the 14.12. And contrary to that, you have in the right below it is if we move contributions to 14.12%, which is where we're going with this 2.87 increase, 50% employee, 50% state, you can see that the funded ratio doesn't dip down below that point and of that 70%. And you also find, to tell you what that means, in that 2041, when that says 0% funded ratio, that's when your current contributions are paying out your benefits because there's zero in the plan. And that's what you're talking about. And that's when you're talking about to cut benefits. And I want to bring up a couple of points to you. The question comes up is this have to do with the market performance in 2007, November through March of 2009? And the answer is that's not the main reason. That just brought it to light. That exacerbated the problem. This has already existed within the plan. And at 11.25%, we were never built to fund at this ratio. And also, we were never built to fund COLAs. And that's the other major piece that came into this. When we were overfunded, actuarially overfunded, late 90s, early 2000, big dot-com craze, they call it a new economy. You had a period where we said, okay, we're overfunded. Let's spin out some COLAs to people. Well, what happens is that's your cushion for your downturn. Now, if we would not have done those COLAs, that does not mean that we wouldn't have to do this raise. It just wouldn't have been brought to bright light with us. We'd be just a little bit closer to actuarially fully funded. This is an unfunded a systematically unfunded, not a market unfunded situation.
also, when you look at where this goes, it's $100 million a year. As you know, we have just under $50 million set in the auditor's office to cover the state's half of the contribution for the biennium. But that leaves us with $50 million short. And that's where we come with this split of 144 for the state, 143 for the employees. Within that folded sheet also is the data on national contribution rates. And then the final page is a comparison of contribution rates and what the average is of these pieces. Who's giving them, employer, employee, which one of the employees are paying 100% of their employee contribution. And as a reminder, we had a 50-50 split until 1986 of the employees actually paying their contribution, but in that year the state gave a pay raise in the form of picking up contributions. One of the most important reasons right now why we need to take it on today is because if we don't, this problem just gets worse, as you can see on that plan. And I would bring to your attention 9-3-429 within our statute. And this is a piece that's very common written within many of the public pension plans out there. And I want to read this to you. Section A, nothing in this article shall be construed to, and then we go down to Romanet 2, constitute a contract of binding obligation of any kind whatsoever to create or grant any vested right or interest in any individual, corporation, or public body. Basically says is that if we become unfunded, we don't owe benefits. That the state does not owe the benefits out because this is the clause. So where you get down the road from here is all of a sudden we're at a point where we're 60% actuarially funded, to a point where we'd have to put in probably $2.5 billion in 1 year to make up the gap, and at that point the future legislative body that we put this on is going to say, well, you know what? What if we cut benefits by 15% or 20%? And I'm not talking about just the ones for the people who are going to retire, but the ones who are already retired, who've been out of the workforce for 20 years, haven't been to school in 20 years, and now say you have a 20% pay cut. That's just what you have to deal with. And that's a significant thing to deal with. We have an opportunity right now to head this off at the pass, and I tell you, this isn't something that, and you notice that my little scale goes out to 2041 to show you the worst case. I remind you, it's 2013 that you're actuarially unfunded. And it's 2013 that you have to make the decisions on benefits or where we're bringing money and rating what from. And I'll stand for questions at this point.
Representative Madden.
I'm speaking, I guess, kind of in tandem with the bringer of the amendment. I serve as a liaison to the retirement board here in Wyoming, and have been for the last years. And I've attended all their meetings, and I've also got a lot of experience in other retirement systems in either a administrative capacity or a management capacity. And I wanted to call your attention to a couple of handouts that I've passed out. They came both at the same time. And the first one that I want to talk about is the black and white one. This is prepared by a agency or a organization, a research think tank, if you will, that deals with retirement systems, and they're well-respected and well-known within the retirement management community. And what I've done is I've cut and pasted a little bit, as you can see here, and the graph you see on the left, is the pattern of liabilities to assets of the Wyoming retirement system, okay? And as the gentleman just preceding me was saying, we were overfunded in the year 2000, and that shows at the initial points of those two lines where the assets was actually higher than liabilities. Well, that set off a flurry of improvement of benefits because of those short-term dot-com gains and so forth. And you can see what happened to the path of the liabilities from that point out. And since 2001, these lines crossed, and they've never crossed again. Now, that gap that you see here between the lines beginning in 2001 and going up to right where they abruptly split apart, that's what we refer to in the business as a structural funding deficit, okay? That's something that's been there and it can't be actuarially expected to clear itself out unless you have extraordinary, excellent returns over an extended period of time in your investment markets. Now, the last disjointed move that was made, particularly in the assets line in 2008, that was, you know, what we experienced with the precipitous drop in the market. That's not the same thing. Remember that we were talking about there's a market-induced funding deficit and there's a structural deficit. All from 2001 to 2007, we were under the structural deficit. What we're trying to fix in this bill, folks, is that thing right there. We can't fix that market deficit. We just got to hope that the market will fix itself. This will just correct that deficit that we see in the funding level of the retirement system that's inherent within it. Okay? Now, the next page is a picture of the United States. It's color-coded, and I'll show you that one. You'll see there's different levels of or different colors here. The white states that you see there, these are the worst performing states. These are the ones that is similar to the year 2013 that I'm talking about or your previous speaker talked about on this. But the key thing to remember is that those white states were once a various shade of blue. And that's the next thing you need to understand and why this is so important. Underfunding begets more underfunding or more severe underfunding. So the best time to fix an underfunding problem is yesterday. The other thing to consider in regard to this is that, you know, what if we just fix half of it today and we just let the other half slide for a year or so? When we come back here again and say, okay, well, we got to fix it then, it's not going to be 1.43% anymore. It's going to be 1.53. It never gets better unless you have extraordinary good returns. Now, what is it we want to do by passage of this bill? On the right-hand side of the previous black and white handout I gave you, this is a neighboring state's experience over the same time period as our experience, okay? And you'll see that those two graphs the two lines on that graph are almost superimposed on one another, okay? And if you look at the bottom there, you'll see a pig. the pig with that state is a full-colored pig, all right? And that means it's a solid performer. And the pig over on the Wyoming side is a half-colored pig. And that means it needs improvement. This isn't my evaluation. This is the evaluation of this state or this national think tank that evaluates comparative firms. If you want to have your own state, favorite state, any of those states that's on this color map that I gave you, you can just get on that website and it'll take you right to that state and tell you where they were before they got to where they are today. You can see that we're not a white state, we're not even the lightest blue state, but the state immediately south of Wyoming was the same color that we were 4 years ago. And that's the kind of colors that we're going to transition to if we don't take proactive action on this. Now, when you talk to employees, they'll write you emails and things like that, and I'm very careful to write back to them immediately and explain these kind of things that I've talked about to you. Once they understand that, you know, some of them will start out with you and say, well, why don't, it's your retirement system, why don't you fix it yourself? That's the kind of letters I like the best, because I write back to them and I say, wait a minute, this ain't our retirement system. This is your retirement system, and it's your interest to have it fixed. You know, why wouldn't you want a retirement system fixed that's going to guarantee you 2.15% times the number of years you serve, times your final average salary for the rest of your life till you die? I mean, we're talking about a peanuts here. We're talking about like $35 a month. What's that? $9 a week to heal this up and to have the assurance when you go to bed at night that this system is going to be there at the current level of benefits that we have now. Another thing I think that's important to realize is that a side benefit of this little exercise has been that there's been a kind of a new discovery on the part of members that, you know, it is my retirement system, you know, and I shouldn't have this. I shouldn't look at the state as being my paternalistic partner until I die. You know, it's in my interest as an employee to have this healthy and wealthy and solid until eternity. These kind of defined benefit programs are scarce as chicken's teeth nowadays. And we want to make sure that ours doesn't go by the wayside like a lot of others, particularly in the private sector, have. Thank you for your time.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I would move Standing Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 72 and ask for your favorable consideration. This amendment, as I'm sure you're all aware, is designed to delay the employee contribution, not the employer, the employee contribution for 1 year. I couldn't agree more with what has been said by the bringers of this to our floor. I couldn't agree more of the importance to fix our retirement system. I couldn't agree more that it's an excellent retirement system. I couldn't agree more that 1.43% isn't very much. This is an important piece of legislation. It absolutely is. And this isn't about negating anything in there. This is about looking at the between 35 and 36,000 Wyoming citizens who are members of the Wyoming retirement system, members of it and had no idea that this was coming. The good speaker previously talked about emails he was receiving. I've been receiving a lot of emails. I'll bet you all have. And they're all scared. They're all asking what's happening because we don't know. The bill is asking them to only pay 1.43%. That isn't much. But if you look, take somebody who makes $40,000 a year, kind of a moderate sort of salary. That's $50 a month for them. So then add that on up. Now, that's not that much, is it? But if you don't know it's coming and you're also paying excess increased insurance costs, increased everything costs in this time of uncertainty in our financial situation, that can be a lot, and that can add up, especially when you didn't know it was coming. And the take home less, which is obviously what this will be, doesn't just impact the individuals, doesn't just impact the members of the retirement system. It impacts our business communities, who are not going to see that money spent, who are going to see that decrease in spending power. Now, currently, there's $5.6 billion in the system. I understand it needs to be fixed. I understand that 2013 is our magic year. I understand all that.
And I also am absolutely not saying that employees shouldn't have to pony up and contribute a bit to their own system. I'm not saying anybody should get a free ride. I am saying that if there was just 1 year, 1 year for a private citizen to be educated about this, I know we're trying to, as we get the emails, we're trying very hard to say the sky is not falling. But if we had that 1 year to explain the small amount in relation to other states, the small amount in relation to what they get, the small amount that gives so much, if they had that 1 year where they could plan for it, that 1 year for our citizens to budget for it, that 1 year for us to educate, so that they can have a better understanding of what's being asked of them. They can understand the need for it. Now, the amendment that I am proposing advocates a staged approach. The employer's contributions will begin just as the bill states in 7-1-2010. The employees will begin 7-1-2011. This was a suggestion from the governor, who does have $48 million in the state auditor's office. He's acknowledged the need that we have to have additional money into the system, and it's been set aside. But he also recognizes the need to defer for 1 year for our employees. That can be a one-time injection. It can be in stages. I would urge your consideration of this amendment, which does not seek to do anything to the bill, acknowledges the importance of this legislation, acknowledges our responsibility, asks for a 1 year deferment for the employees only. Thank you.
We are on the amendment, the House, excuse me, the We're on amendment number one. Discussion. Representative
Harshman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, I know, sitting up there, I got to have the map because I look at you guys, you all look the same after a while. But especially these guys back in the corner. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd urge your defeat of the amendment. And I'm one of those state employees as a teacher. It'll be another $50, $60 a month out of my check. My wife's a teacher, so that'll be another 50, 60. We got four children. I know all those things, and I've really, I've supported the governor's position early on. We've studied this for 4 years in JAC. It's just not going to get any better, folks. And I'll just tell you, as one of those employees that's being advocated for in this amendment, I will also say I've heard from a lot of employees, once they know the facts, they, like me, want nothing more than the solid retirement plan that has really been promised to us when we joined up. And we have done such a wonderful job in this state and have really a good plan that's managed well, great benefits for our state employees, not paid a cent into it since 1985, 6, 7, somewhere in there. That's just unheard of. Every state in the country is paying, employees are paying part of their own share. So as an employee, feel pretty good about my employer's going to pay 13-some-odd percent, and I'm going to pay 1.43. That's a pretty good deal no matter how you slice it. And I just think the risk of not doing this, well, there's no risk. It's a certainty of not doing this. It overwhelms any considerations of election year politics, election year thinking. Any heartstrings you pull, because the real heartstrings will be pulled. I had a relative who was a public employee in Michigan when they had to pancake them and they got 10% of what they were promised. That's pulling on your heartstrings. And none of us want to put that on future legislators. And so I'd urge you to defeat this amendment and pass the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd urge you to vote aye on this amendment. Now, not everybody in state government employment makes as much as that teacher makes. So let's think about the people that don't make a lot of money And what we're asking with this amendment is to postpone their contribution for 1 year. That's all. Then they've got their self together. They understand it's coming. They understand what has to be done. But we're asking just 1 year postponement, and then they'll be in good shape. Don't know whether how good, but let's think about the people that aren't highly paid that need a little help right now, and let's help them postpone it for a year, and then we'll get right back into it. I don't think that's going to hurt anything, and I believe that's what really has been proposed from downstairs.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm asking you not to approve this amendment. We have talked today a lot about the dangers of postponing. This has got a genesis to it. We've heard this 5 years ago. Let's wait till next year and see if things get better. Let's wait till next year, and then the next year comes. They say, well, let's wait one more year. And this is what we're at to right now. Let's wait one more year so we can come in again next year and say, let's wait one more year again. This is a type of issue that is a long-term issue, and it doesn't get better by waiting a year. If we wait a year on this, the number is no longer 1.43. The other thing to look at is that this is not an onerous expectation on the part of employees. There's an organization that's got a representative right out here in the hall that says, please pass this in the way it is now without this amendment, because they realize the importance of it. Their employees that they represent are saying it's a lot more important for me to have a solvent retirement system than to save $30 a month or something like that. I just urge you to look at this table of all the contribution rates that are out there in these other states. Ours is a little misleading because the employee contribution for the most part is paid by the employee or employer, but all the rest of them, those are true numbers. Employees are making 5%, 6%, 7% contributions. You know, there would be a financial hardship if we're talking about all of a sudden, socking it to an employee at 5% or 6%. But we're just asking for enough as a partner to get this thing healed up so we don't have to come back again next year and say one more year. Thank you.
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems to me that this is a cancer on the state budget. It's something that we know it's there. It's a certainty or an almost certainty, and we know it's going to grow, and we know it's going to get worse. So we can take a little bit of a small shot pain and have a little bit of a painful treatment, or we can wait a year and have a more distasteful treatment, and we can wait longer, and the longer we wait, the more distasteful it gets. It's our obligation, I think, to make sure that other people who succeed us in these chairs don't have to make more and more and more distasteful decisions. It seems like this is an obvious thing. Putting it off a year just means it's going to get worse for a year. So let's make the hard decision now. Let's solve the problem and go on to other problems that we have to solve rather than burdening our future successors and our future budgets and have all of these future issues tied up because we couldn't make the tough decision now.
We're on Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 1. Representative McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make clear a little misunderstanding, I'll call it up. Because we've been talking about how we are very fortunate, and we are fortunate that the state is paying the employee share of this contribution. However, Mr. Chairman, that was done to the employees in lieu of a raise in pay. So that, to make that kind of a comparison is not really correct. And I'd like to clear that up. That was, everybody would have been making more money. And it would be costing the state more money because they'd be having to pay more Social Security. They'd be having to pay more into the retirement system for those higher gross wages. However, about the amendment, yesterday I was on the amendment, and I have been convinced in talking to the people on the floor that with this plan, if we put this off, even delay this 1 month, 1 year, it will be 1.5 or 1.6, and the same people that are out there now that are going to be paying this in will still not be ever guaranteed a COLA. And if we want to get this plan fixed and have some kind of a COLA for retirees once they retire, I think we need to start now. So while I support and feel empathy for my state employees, and believe me, Fremont County's got the second largest amount of public employees, state public employees in Wyoming, I think that I've got to support the bill as it is because I owe it to my constituents, and they are my constituents. This plan needs to be fixed. It needs to be fixed now, as soon as possible, on and against the amendment.
We are speaking on the amendment of the whole. Number one, Representative Gilmore.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'll make this short. As a retired state employee, I enjoy my pension. I'm the first to admit it's in trouble. I think one of the reasons that this has become such an issue, I don't know one state employee that wouldn't pay the $50 a month. I guess what we're leaving out is that same state employee that's paying the $50 a month has no chance for a raise this year or next year. Plus, they earlier heard that the governor put the $48 million aside to fund their portion of it because their insurance policy went up. So basically, they had to pay another $100 a month into insurance with no raise. That came out of their check. Now another $50. So we keep chipping away at these state employees. And I don't feel sorry for the 50,000 on up state employees. What concerns me is the secretaries and the grunts who actually do the work and the people you see plowing the snow. You know, that adds up to them. And that was the only reason I was in favor of the delaying it for 1 year. And I agree, it's inevitable. We need to fix the plan. And incidentally, I haven't gotten a COLA either.
Representative Brown.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I talked a while ago about cold hearts, and everybody kind of poo-pooed that, but we're going to have a vote here in a minute. We're going to find out who's got a cold heart and who doesn't.
Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's talk about what this really is. And I know some of you are calling this a cut, a reduction in their wages, but yeah, let's call it like we see it. What we're doing, we're asking our employees to invest in their future, and this is coming from someone who doesn't have that great of a retirement plan. Believe me, I got a bunch of green paint in my backyard that's my retirement. Now, any investment person I talk to will tell me if someone's going to match you dime for dime, dollar for dollar, for anything you can invest in your future, you take it and you say thank you. On and against the amendment.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, I ask you to vote no on this amendment. For the 4 years, we have heard this bill about retirement system. And we've struggled with it, and we've delayed it, and we've asked for studies, and we've had actuarials come in. And quite honestly, I have more than a foot high of retirement system information. I also thought when I came down here in January to work on the budget that this was something that we could delay. But as we met every week with the retirement system, we discovered that it is urgent that we put additional funding into this system. And the reason I decided that this was important to bring now and to act on it is because I want to secure and ensure for our state employees or our public service employees that they do have a future retirement. And that I think this is the time, I've said this before, there's never a perfect time to do many of our actions. But when we get the information and we realize that it is urgent, I think it's critical that we do it today. So I ask you to vote no on this amendment and aye for the bill. Thank you.
Representative Harshman.
Thank you for my last time on this. I, you know, just there was a comment about, and it's true, back in the mid-'80s that we fully fund retirement for in lieu of pay raises, but that's gone away. You know, we've just finished now with JC through A&I. We've done a complete with a large international corporation to study our whole pay and everybody. In fact, we've allocated a few million more dollars this year to bring everybody within that 85% band of market pay. So our state employees are some of the best paid in the country. And our teachers, you know, we are 47th state out of 50 here. A few years ago, we've moved up to about 15th. So we've done a lot of good. The last thing I guess I would leave you with, and I want all you folks in the private sector, you know, if you have $1 million saved, now let me, it'd actually be closer to 2 million, my broker back here tells me. How many of you got 2 million saved ready for retirement? Okay. Because that's the average benefit that a state employee like myself will receive if the Lord blesses me with the average lifespan, 85 years of age, the benefits I'll receive through this defined benefit plan. I would have had to have $2 million in the bank. Now, it's a great deal. And it would really be a shame if we can't do a little bit to make sure this thing goes on forever, really, for future state employees. So it's the best deal going. It's part of the deal that we sign on for state employees. And I really urge you to reject this, and then let's pass this and move on. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in summary, in terms of some of the things that have been said, you know, I just heard from the last speaker that we can't fully fund the retirement anymore. That's gone away. I understand that, but those people out there don't. They haven't heard that. They don't know that. They're not getting a COLA. They're getting rising costs on their insurance. They're getting hit every which direction. Now the retirement, which they don't understand, they think it's considerably more than the 1.43% we're looking at right now. They don't get it. They didn't sign on for that. And they have heard in every publication in this state that the governor put money in the auditor's office so they wouldn't have to think about it this year. They could think about it next year, and they could plan for it next year. And we're not talking about, it's my system. It's not going to hurt me to pay that extra money. It's not going to hurt me even remotely. But I can name hundreds, and I know you all can too, that it's going to hurt because they haven't budgeted for it, and they don't know about it, and they don't know it's coming. And now they're hearing that on top of everything else, guess what? You have to pay into your retirement system. I understand we have to. I agree it's the best system. I want the savings for a retirement. I get all that. I want the 1 year for all those people out there that don't get it, haven't budgeted, haven't even thought about it, to think about it, budget for it, plan for it, give us a year to educate them, use that set-aside money. I would urge your support of the amendment, and I would call the question on the amendment.
We are in committee of the whole, amendment number one. Is there any other discussion? Representative Jorgensen? Okay, the question having been called, all those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no.
No.
The chairman is unsure. All those in favor, please stand. All those opposed, please stand. Pursuant to Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 has failed. All those, we are now on the bill. Question being called, all those in favor of Representative Berger's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that Senate File Number 72 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion has passed. Senate File Number 72 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Representative Lockhart, privilege of the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Privilege of the floor. Thank you for granting it. In the balcony to my left and your right is a woman who works for Rocky Mountain Power that I worked with for about 15 years, and she's done an excellent job those years. She's currently the customer and community manager for Rocky Mountain Power in Wyoming, Leslie Blythe. Leslie, raise your hand so they can see you.
The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 8. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 8, introduced by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to child support, medical support of children. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Begbie, Barbudo, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, Throne. No, Korberg, excused, Blickery. Signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Representative Gingrey?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 8 do pass. And there are no amendments, and I would turn over the explanation of the bill to the good gentleman from House District 3.
Representative Peasley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen of the House, I would given a very controversial bill here again to discuss, and I promise not to launch into any of my usual rants. This is as tame as it gets, and I'll try to walk you through it quickly. Certainly not as controversial as you'd like. In any event, what we have in Wyoming under the many domestic relations laws is a requirement that we establish support for minor children, dependent children. One aspect of that is medical support for these children. Over the years, most of this was handled in the form of a divorce decree or some sort of separation agreement. With the advent of the welfare reform laws of the early 90s, the state became more aggressively involved in the establishment of this support obligation because it became de rigueur for attorneys to advise a couple that had a child out of wedlock for the mother to defer and take no child support, and the father would, of course, exercise no visitation, and it fell upon the state to support the child, and both parents walked away scot-free. We didn't let that continue, and through the mid-90s and late 90s, the state became very aggressive in its child support program and did get involved in an area that was usually occupied only by private attorneys in their divorce negotiations. As a consequence of this, we have a lot of requirements to maintain what we call the 4D program, where the federal government wants to make sure we're setting child support in accordance with reasonable standards. Those standards are shown under Title 20 of our laws, have to do with presumptive child support, and all of you are aware of that. We go through every 5 years or so, and we recalibrate what child support should be based on cost of living. And part and parcel of that, though, is the medical support. And as everyone knows, that becomes far more complicated. We have health insurance issues and the like. And normally in situations where both parents are pretty well set up financially, we have a father, say, who will provide for health care through his employment. Or they'll agree with the mother. Mother has a better job. She'll get it. But there's still a lot of people out there without those tools. And as a consequence, you're sometimes faced with a situation where you have to set child support. And let's assume the father is the non-custodial parent. The mother is the custodial parent. The support is set based on some ratio between their incomes. But then the court turns to the father and the mother and says, what about health insurance for this child? And neither can afford it. The court has to make some finding or allowance to take care of that, because those parents are what we call jointly and severally responsible for the health care of that child. And it becomes difficult. And I worked in this area for about 8 years, and it became very difficult and problematic when you had to address it. And quite often what you had to say, well, if one of you can get it, you'll get it. And when you get it, you'll pay for it. And whatever's not covered by the insurance, you two will split. And we have a lot of weird orders out there running around looking like that. Well, on the side is, of course, the 4D program. And now the federal government has said, Wyoming, your loosey-goosey manner of doing this has got to be fixed. We need to have a standard that you'll use. And so the bill. And the bill, I'll just walk you through it quickly. It tries to set some standard, at least a minimum standard, that will pass muster with the 4D auditors as they trump through our state and pull all of our funds if we're not compliant. And I would appreciate comments from anybody that's worked in this area if you've got concerns. I didn't care for the bill when it first came in, but as I read it and thought about it, the more I realize that maybe this doesn't cause any harm, and it patches up a spot that the state has a problem with. So all of you, I know, have gotten my handout. It's called Senate File Number 0008, which would be the bill, and that's my only handout. On there, it refers at Section 1. It tracks you to Title 20, Chapter 2, Article 4. Medical support to be included as part of a child support order. Okay, that is reads as the statute, page 1. You go over to page 2, and the way the statute is set up, I've got the regular statute book that I'm used to, there's two ways the court can do it. One, it can say, all right, one of you got to carry health insurance, and we'll then provide for how we allocate the other things that are not covered by medical or by health insurance. That's the best order. That's the way you want to do it. Somebody's got the fallback position of the health insurance, and then they have an allocation between the two of them on what they do about stuff that's not covered by the insurance. But our statute, recognizing you're not always going to have affordable insurance, says, or the court can specify in its order the portion for which the parent shall be liable for any medical expenses, which may include dental, optical, or other health care expenses incurred by the person or an agency on behalf of the child if the expenses are not covered by insurance. That just isn't good enough. We need to specify a little more clearly for the benefit of the feds what we're talking about there. And so what the bill does, and now I'm on page 2, what we used to say there was the support order would require, and I'm on page 2 reading, and I know most of you are not following this, but I'll indulge myself. From line 6 to 11, says that one or both parents shall provide insurance coverage for the child if insurance can be obtained. And originally we said through an employer, but there's other ways to do it. So we struck the employer or other group carrier and said simply, if it can be provided at a reasonable cost and the benefits under the insurance policy are accessible to the children. Okay? All that does is make it a little more broad. Then B of that is, in addition to getting the insurance, we take out one or both. We say, and that both parents will be liable to pay for medical expenses not covered by the insurance and any deductible amounts on the required insurance coverage as, and we're going to add the terms, as cash medical support, okay? Because we can give that a definition that satisfies the feds. And this doesn't, I don't think, do any damage to what we do already. It just gives us a definable point. All right, then those two paragraphs are followed by the or, and we fall into that section where we don't have the health insurance. Now, is it true if I just talk long enough, somebody will scream question? Okay, that's what I thought. All right. Just want to make sure you're still out there. All right. Section 2. This is the one where you can't get the health insurance, and I'm at line 18, page 2. If the court doesn't have the insurance and doesn't have to cover all that, then it can just specify in the order for how everything will be divvied up, and the parties will be liable for any medical expenses as cash medical support. Now, that cash medical support language we put in there, that is, I think, always been understood by the courts, or at least to the extent that the court will address it, the court understands there's a lot of subtle problems they've got out there. Everything from aspirin to, all the Rx, all the pharmaceuticals, but there's all these non-pharmaceutical type of expenses. Cash medical support, and it inserts it there, and that will make the feds happy. And it doesn't screw up, I don't think, any private practice work. Now, we have to define those terms to satisfy them. So then we jump back a little bit in Article 4, where they have definitions, and we add 3 new definitions. One we talk about, and I'm on page 3 of the bill for those of you in Rio Linda and following what I'm trying to say here. Accessible simply means that the health insurance plan is available and provides coverage for the child residing with the geographic area covered by the insurance plan. All I know is that seems to be where we're going on insurance policies, and I guess that's okay. Secondly, we define the cash medical support, and this was the area that I had the most concern with. What do we mean when we don't have health insurance and we're not going to say certain percentages? What do we mean by cash medical support? It means any child support order, and here's the weird thing, any child support order calculated pursuant to Article 3 of the chapter. Now, all that means is if we don't have anybody that can carry health insurance, but if you establish child support in accordance with the guidelines, it factors in that medical support. Now, I'm sure everybody here remembers clearly in our discussion on child support how we factored in those cash medicals that are incurred by parents during a year for a child when we calculated what a father or an absent parent's support should be for a child. So we're allowing, if the court's not going to require any other coverage for health care, that if at least the court has set child support according to guidelines, that will be sufficient for purposes of 4D. Okay? I see 25 deer in the headlights, so let me try that one more time. When we set child support in a modification or an establishment case, when we set it, we've already factored in some cash support for the child. Now, you should never stop there, and I would scream at the state of Wyoming if they don't go any further. But there are cases, non-custodial parent in jail. You have a lot of those types of cases where you can't do any better than that. And, of course, these orders can always be modified. So if we do at least that, we maybe don't get him to carry insurance because he can't, but at least we've set his support obligation, then included in that support obligation, if it's calculated according to guidelines, is some health care. And that alone is enough to get us in compliance with the 4D program. Now, don't be worried, because these little children won't have to put up with that, because earlier today you provided for lawyers to represent everybody. So we'll have plenty of lawyers out there now representing these people. And the if you look at that section, it goes on. It says, if you don't like that, it says, or an amount ordered to be paid toward the cost of health care coverage provided by the other parent through the parent's employer or otherwise, or for other medical costs not covered by insurance. So what I'm telling you is, when you go in front of the judge, you can use one of those three. But if you have to use that first one, which I call the soft version, at least the state of Wyoming is not out of compliance with this federal program. All right? Now, you know there's nobody that hates bills more than me, so this was a tough swallow, but I buy that. I think that's okay. And if anybody's got a better thought on it, let me know. But at least then, when the 4D people sit down on these forced situations where a child born out of wedlock, they're trying to establish, and they don't have parents that can afford insurance, they don't have any kind of income, they don't know what to do with them, at least they can say, well, listen, for now we're going to set your support pursuant to guidelines, and that'll take care of the health provision of it, and that you can always come back and modify that. And I would also suggest that my guess is that both parents still remain jointly and severally liable for those costs, regardless of what the court says, at least if a health care provider wanted to follow up on it. In any event, that's the meat of this. Now, the next paragraph, the other definition given, was reasonable cost. This is the only place I think there might be some viable debate, but I'm going to discourage it. Reasonable cost is defined. This is where you're trying to define whether or not the reasonable cost of the insurance. Okay, is this reasonable? Okay, Dad can get insurance for $20,000 a month, or he can pay as much as I did, which was like $2,000 a month, and you pay that much, but Dad doesn't have that kind of income. So what's reasonable before we're going to let him off the hook for providing insurance? And I don't mean to be sexist by using Dad as my non-custodial parent. It's just easier for me, because that's usually the case. In any event, the non-custodial parent, at what level do we force him to carry it? Well, it's at a level at which it is at a reasonable cost. And we have decided to define reasonable cost for health care or to provide cash medical support no more than 5% of their gross income. Okay? Which is a pretty good deal, I think. But in any event, that's where we are. That's what the bill does. This bill saves our child support 4D program. We can continue to help these people get child support set up for the kids. And that's the bill. And I guess my next comment is, I stand for questions. Oh, come on. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Gingery's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 8 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 8 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 9. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 9, introduced by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to juvenile detention facilities standards. This bill was referred to the Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Begbie, Barbudo, Blickery, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Peasley, Quarburg, Throne. Signed, representing Gingrey, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Representative Gingery?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 9 do pass. There are no amendments. There's a handout in your box, and the good gentleman from House District 15 will explain the bill.
Representative Bagby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring you Senate File 9, Juvenile Detention Facilities Standard. It's an act relating to juvenile detention, requiring sheriffs to develop and implement standards for juvenile detention facilities as specified, requiring a report and providing definitions. And this creates a new section down in WS 14-4-117. And this, we've worked on this. This has been an interim topic bill in Judiciary, and we've worked on it and worked on it, and we come up with this new section. And this next section on page 1, line 14 to 16, and then on over is actually the heart of the bill. It says, sheriffs in consultation with other operators of juvenile detention facilities shall develop and implement uniform standards after consideration of recognized criteria for the operation of all hardware secure and staff secure juvenile detention facilities. No minor shall be detained in a hardware secure or staff secure juvenile detention facility unless the facility has adopted the standards specified under subsection. And then it goes on down to explain the definitions on page 2, line 16, hardware secure juvenile detention facility means a facility used for the detention of minors that is characterized by locks on the doors and other restrictive hardware designed to restrict the movement of the minors and protect public safety. And if you look at this handout, it'll kind of explain that to you. Going down to page 2, line 22, staff secure juvenile detention facility means a facility used for the detention of minors that is characterized by a trained staff to supervise the movements and activities of detained minors at the facility without the additional use of hardware secure equipment. And this goes into effect March 31st, 2013. There are 5 private facilities in 5 regions around the state, and this bill requires that county sheriffs be sure that facilities meet uniform standards. In Wyoming, there is a very small percentage that end up in hardware secure or jail-like facilities for extremely serious crimes like armed robbery, murder, and violent crimes. This bill brings Wyoming into compliance with the National Juvenile Uniform Detention Standard. Mr. Chairman, I stand for questions. If there is no questions, I call for the question.
The question being called, all those in favor of Representative Gingery's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 9 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 9 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 3. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 3, introduced by the Agriculture Committee, an act relating to apiary laws. This bill was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State, and Public Lands and Water Resources, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Edmonds, Gilmore, Moniz, Semlek, Dieters, Wallace, Zwanitzer, Dan. Signed, Representative Semlek, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Representative Semlek?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee of the whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that bill number or Senate file number 3 do pass. I will turn the explanation of the bill over to the good representative from House District 43.
Representative Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm pleased to present Senate File 3 apiary laws brought to you by the Joint Ag, State, and Public Lands and Water Resources Interim Committee. You should have all received a handout about half an hour ago that says Senate File 3 on it, on your desk in that pile of paperwork. It took out all of my talking points, but I will do my best to get through this quickly. Basically, in our apiary laws now in Wyoming, all of our bee colonies and hives have to be registered with the state. It prevents too many bees from being in too close of density and spreading diseases, that kind of things. But we're creating a couple new classes. The first one is found on page 1 in 11.7.2.13, where we're doing holding yards for apiaries. And basically, this is when you're traveling from state to state and before your bees are ready to go out in the field, we're doing a temporary kind of holding area, as long as you're not producing honey. And you can't do that for more in section D on line 15, for more than 2 months in the spring and 2 months in the fall. We're also creating on page 2 under 11.7.2.14 spray yard locations so you can move your hives from a field while they're spraying pesticides or other chemicals to allow for a safe haven for the bees. You can't do that for more than 16 days. One more classification is found in 11.7.2.15 in variance agreements. And basically, if something happens to the land, a drought, a CRP program, or anything else, you can get a variance from the Department of Agriculture to transfer your bees to a separate location. That is the new statutes. In Section 2 on page 4, we're amending current existing law under the definitions. Basically, in Romanet 2, we're just adding bee parasites and bee pests into bee diseases. And then we further define what bee parasites are and bee pests are there on line 5. We also define what a general beekeeper is there on lines 22 through 24 of page 5 to differentiate them from hobby beekeepers. Basically, if you have more than 5 hives and manage and operate these hives, you're an official general beekeeper and not a hobby beekeeper. Moving on to page 6, just talks about apiary registrations. Only thing you guys really need to know, we're changing from section township range to a latitude and longitude coordinate system using GPS that becomes effective July 1st, 2012. The rest of the bill after that is just conforming language through page 11. On page 11, one other change to our current law is we're basically allowing inspectors to have a 7 consecutive day period where they can undertake inspection of these colonies and hives around the state. And then we are also taking out the limiting language they put in 1984 on interstate travel of bees. A lot of our communities, especially in the northwest part of the state, they would like to be able to transfer these colonies over state lines. We didn't used to allow that. But they say the technology and the safety requirements are in place now to permit that. So on page 12, you'll find the Department of Ag can do a certificate for any colony imported into Wyoming or exported out of Wyoming for up to 1 year. We're also repealing Section 3 there on line 15 of page 12. All that is old language when we re-updated the statute from 1983, clarifying the law stayed in place through 1984, and all contracts were in effect at that point. The law does become valid July 1st, 2010. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have. Otherwise, I'd call for the question.
The question being called, all those in favor of Representative Semlich's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File Number 3 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Those opposed, no. Senate File 3 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Representative Buchanan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion carries.
The reading clerk will read the committee of the whole report.
Mr. Speaker, your committee of the whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. Senate file 4, recommended do pass. Senate file 5, recommended do pass. Senate file 10, amended, recommended do pass. Senate file 11, amended, recommended do pass. Senate file 12, amended, recommended do pass. Senate file 19, recommended do pass. Senate file 63, recommended do pass. Senate file 26, recommended do pass. Senate file 28, amended, recommended do pass. Representative Buchanan moved that the committee of the whole rise and sit again. Motion prevailed. Senate file 16, recommended do pass. Senate file 17, following a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. Senate file 43, recommended do pass. Senate file 47, amended and further amended, recommended do pass. Senate file 51, recommended do pass. Senate file 72, recommended do pass. Senate file 8, recommended do pass. Senate file 9, recommended do pass. Senate file 3, recommended do pass. Signed, Representative Blickery, Chairman.
Excuse me, Representative Blickery.
Madam Chairperson, I move the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion carries. Congratulations, Representative Blickery. Messages from the Senate.
Message 165, Mr. Speaker. The bills as below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 2, Veterinarians, ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Anna Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 166, Mr. Speaker. The bills as below pass the Senate on third reading in the vote indicated. House Bill 4, Criminal Procedure, Time Limits for Competency Evaluations. Senate respectfully asks the House to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Signed, Diana Williams and Senate Chief Clerk. Message 167, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 7, Election Code Revisions, ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williams and Senate Chief Clerk. Message 168, Mr. Speaker, House Bill 12, Juvenile Detention Facilities Admissions Criteria. The House bill listed above passed on third reading in amended form by the vote indicated. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, the Senate respectfully asks the House to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Signed, Diana Williams and Senate Chief Clerk. Message 163, Mr. Speaker. House Bill 13, Underage Drinking. The House bill listed above passed on third reading in amended form by the vote indicated. Ayes 20, no 10. The Senate respectfully asks the House to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 170. Mr. Speaker, House Bill 16, Private School Licensing Exemption. The House bill listed above passed on a third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Ayes 29, noes 1. The Senate respectfully asks the House to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 69, respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Hammonds, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Stewart, excused, Phelps. Signed, Representative Berger, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom was referred Senate File 20 engrossed, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Cohey, Gilmore, Madden, McKim, Peterson, Zwanitzer, Dave, excused, Hallinan, signed, Representative Cohey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom was referred Senate File 40, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Cohey, Gilmore, Madden, McKim, Peterson, no, Zwanitzer, Dave, excused, Hallinan, signed, Representative Cohey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom was referred Senate File 56, engrossed, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Cohey, Gilmore, Madden, McKim, Peterson, Zwanitzer, Dave, excused, Hallinan, signed, Representative Cohey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom was referred Senate File 62, respectfully your report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Cohey, Gilmore, Madden, McKim, Peterson, Zwanitzer, Dave, excused, Hallinan, signed, Representative Cohey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom was referred Senate File 71, engrossed, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Cohey, Gilmore, Madden, McKim, Peterson, Zwanitzer, Dave, excused, Hallinan, signed, Representative Cohey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred Senate File 27, engrossed, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Byrd, Kraft, Harvey, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stupson, Zwanitzer, Dave, signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Madam Majority Whip. I move that the House adjourn until Thursday, February 25th, 2010, at 10 a.m.
Committee assignments, or committee announcements, excuse me. Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Madam Majority Whip. Your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, will meet tomorrow at noon recess to consider Senate File 67, Pharmacy Benefits Management.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Madam Majority Whip. Your committee number 4, Education, will meet immediately upon adjournment in room H10, where we will consider the following bills: Senate File 46, Engrossed, School Facilities, Charter Schools, and Senate File 39, Post-Secondary Education Options Program.
Chairman Gingery.
Thank you, Madam Majority Whip. Your committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet immediately upon adjournment in 5 minutes in room H8 to hear Senate File 54, Confirmation of Appointment, Senate File 53, Obsolete Laws, Senate File 65, Termination of Parental Rights, and then tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., we will hear Senate File 68, Supreme Court Peace Officer, and Senate File 15, Title 25 Revisions.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet Friday morning at 8 a.m., H18, to hear 3 Senate files, 66, Industrial Siting Amendments, 59, Workers' Compensation Firefighters, and 52, Reduced Cigarette Ignition Propensity. And I would just like to thank the people that have brought their checks to Lori Millen on Race for the Cure, and you can look at the trophy you earned last year.
I'd like to remind the body that we still have a motion on the floor. We have not adjourned, so please maintain a quorum on the floor. Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Madam Majority Whip. I'd like to announce that the Appropriations Committee 2 will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in Appropriations Room 204 to hear Senate File 42 and any other re-referred bills. And also, Chairman, just to remind you that it's important that you
get any re-referred bills to JAC tomorrow, considering that Friday possibly we will try to do conference on the budget. Thank
Chairman
you.
Simlick.
Thank you, Madam Majority Whip. Your Agriculture Committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, will meet Thursday, February 25th at 8 a.m. in H-11 to consider Senate File 7, Engrossed Rangeland Health Assessments, and Senate File 13, Economic Analysis, and we will also have a discussion on interim topics. Thank you.
Chairman Cohey.
Thank you, Madam Majority Whip. Your committee number 8 on Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs will meet tomorrow night, Thursday, February 25th, upon adjournment in room 302 to discuss Senate File 22, State Active Duty Medical Expense Reimbursement, Senate File 64, Safety Belt Violations 2, Senate File 45, School Bus Seat Belts, and Senate File 35, Tolling Authority for I-80.
And Chairman Landon.
Madam Majority Whip, Committee Number 10, Labor, will meet today upon adjournment at 10 till 5 in Room 302 to hear Senate File 48, Engrossed Licensure of Midwives. We will meet again tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in Room H-17 to hear Senate File 61, Engrossed Health Insurance Reform 2.
You have heard the majority floor leader's motion that we adjourn until tomorrow, Thursday, February 25th at 10 a.m. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. We are adjourned until tomorrow, Thursday, 25th at 10 a.m.